Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lamberth. Today is Saturday, October 3rd, 2020. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and even Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. Let everybody know why you like it. Give it 5 stars because it makes the algorithm do things to inform people who don't know about the podcast. It allows them to learn about it because, you know, based on the numbers, there are a lot of people who don't know about this podcast. And it would be nice if you're into this show and you like what's going on here, to rate and review it. That's all I ask. You know, I have a Patreon page that you can subscribe to. There's hours and hours of me blabbing more intensely about things and stuff, sometimes with other people, sometimes by myself, but it's good. There's good stuff over there. If you want more of me, sign up for Patreon. It's $3 a month. You get at least 2 premium episodes a month, and there's good stuff over there, you know? It's not anything alt-right. It's not anything that's like Hotepy or super conservative. It's just me. It's just me, a guy from Southern Maryland, trying to live decent most days. So this is episode 454. I have a very special return guest, comedian Gabe Pacheco. He has an album out called Risky Behavior. It's good. It's funny. And you can buy it and stream it wherever you buy and stream your music. You can do that with stand-up comedy. You know, they do that. They do that nowadays. You can do that. I recommend it. I highly recommend it. So check that out. And I'm going to share my conversation that I had with Gabe a few days ago with you in a few minutes. Wow. So what is this? This is Saturday morning. I'm an old guy. I got up super early. I was supposed to make an appointment that didn't happen at this place, and it just didn't happen. So I went to Krispy Kreme, and I hadn't gone to Krispy Kreme. God, this is like maybe my second or third time. I know he's like, hey, fat boy, I know you've been to Krispy. I am a big guy, but I'm not a big sweets guy, but every now and then I do like the sour cream glazed donut, and they had a pumpkin spice donut as well. So I got 4 of them. Now I only ate 2. That was early this morning. I only ate 2 of them, and I'll eat the other ones tomorrow or something. I said, oh, let me get 2 sour cream and 2 pumpkin. And the guy said to me, $10.26. I ordered the donuts in the drive thru and I pulled up and he was like, $10.26. I was like, what? I was like, really? Wow. I didn't know it was going to be that much. I didn't know donuts were that expensive because I don't really get donuts like that. They opened up one right around the time when the pandemic starts, so I guess that was in the spring. They opened up one and I drove past, this is East Rutherford, New Jersey, which is not far from Giant Stadium is in East Rutherford, so it's like maybe it's less than 10 minutes away from Giant Stadium. So I go down there. I was like, oh, let me just check it out. I haven't been. And I was like, $10 for 4 donuts? That's a lot. That's pretty expensive. Am I wrong with that? Am I off base? Because I don't, like, if I go to Dunkin' Donuts, it's usually to get a breakfast sandwich. You know, I like a good sausage, egg, and cheese bagel. No, sausage, egg, and cheese croissant. I'm usually that guy. So when I go there, I would get that. But so I don't know how much donuts cost like that. One time I bought Bialy's. You ever heard of Bialy's? It's like a Danish. It's like a Let me look it up, because some of you might know. I had never heard of it until my boss was telling me about it. And I bought some for the office, for my department. Bialy, a Yiddish word short for Bialy or Bialystoker Kuchen from the city of... What the... Wait, so it's Jewish queen. It's Jewish cuisine. Okay, let me see. I didn't know this was going to be this intense. I didn't know I was going to go down a rabbit hole like this. I'm trying to find the right definition. Some of you are probably rolling your eyes right now. Shit. All right, let me see what I can get. A traditional, this is what you're going to have to deal with. Some of you that are not rolling your eyes, that don't know what a bialy is, I'm reading this Wikipedia overview. Okay, a traditional bialy has a diameter of up to 15 centimeters, 6 inches, and is a chewy yeast roll similar to a bagel. Unlike a bagel, which is boiled before baking, a bialy is simply baked, and instead of a hole in the middle, it has a depression. Before baking, the depression is filled with diced onions and other ingredients, possibly including garlic, poppy seeds, or breadcrumbs. So the ones that I went to Wegmans early in the morning and got, like, they had bialys with like pepperoni and like cheese and like all like garlicky stuff, and they are good. I bought some for the office, and they loved them. They murdered those shits. And it was like, it might have been like $40. But that's more of a, that's almost, I don't know if it's more of a delicacy than I would say a donut is. It's like a upscale breakfast pastry, especially when it has all those fixings. Some people put like cream cheese in them, but these already had the stuff in there. So that was pretty expensive, but it was very good. Wegmans is dope. So if you have a Wegmans near you, check out a bialy sometimes. They'll make you one. Because I told them, I was like, oh, just give me the whole tray of them. I'll buy them all. I felt like a baller. So how did I get on that? Oh, just donuts and, yeah, crispy. That shit's kind of expensive to me. It's pretty expensive. Well, but then it's two breakfast meals, though. I could eat two of them, two donuts. That's my max. So that's two breakfasts, but that was really early this morning. And, yeah, so a lot went on this past week, the debates, which was a shit show. I ended up falling asleep on the last 15 minutes, but it was an abomination. And then now there's just been a COVID outbreak in the White House, and Twitter is in, I wouldn't say it's in shambles, but it's a shit show. I woke up to it, to text and Twitter just being like, I just woke up and my tweet that morning was, y'all wildin'. It's crazy. Now, my thing about it is, I don't wish death on anybody. And I'm not going to lose my humanity because a certain person in his administration made a mockery of the office of the presidency and doesn't care about people. I'm going to try to hold on to my humanity by not partying on that shit. But I have seen I've seen the tweets, and wow, it's not my thing. And I would say I will not judge you, and don't judge me on that. It's just not my thing to party like that. I don't care for that administration, and I have a history of saying that over the last four 4 years of it. So I'm going to move on from that and hope that what I hope people that have been hiding their head in the sand, or that have been that think that this shit's not real, I hope maybe that gives them a change of heart. I hope. Am I pessimistic about that? Yes. But I hope that that some people will learn from all this. That's what I'll say about that. Yeah. And I think it's safe to say I'll leave it at that. And I'll probably be on another couple podcasts this week, and we'll maybe get into that more, but I'll just leave that where it's at right now. And let's get you to Gabe. So Gabe Pacheco, very funny comedian, New York fixture in the comedy scene. He made a really interesting and apropos comment about the comedy scene, what's probably going to happen. And I read it on Instagram. I was like, oh shit. And it just made me think I got to have Gabe back on, and always enjoy talking to this man. And it's been quite some time. It had been like 6 years since the first time he was on. And I just wanted to talk to him. So this is just two comics talking shit. This was on Wednesday. We recorded this past Wednesday. So that would have been the 30th. And so we did not know about the COVID outbreak in the White House and all that. So we didn't know about that then. So we do not touch on that during this episode, but I wanted to get this out early because I'm going to have a busy couple of weeks, and Patreon folks, you'll get something in a couple days. And yeah, so I just wanted to make sure that you got this episode early and in a timely fashion with me talking to the great Gabe Pacheco.
Oh, Chris, I have to say that this has been the best year of my life. It's great, dude. It's great. Because first off, March started with my live-in fiance and I breaking it off.
Okay.
And so, you know, there's no better way to begin a pandemic than single. And what was really crazy about it was I didn't break up with her. She rolled over in bed March 1st and said, I think this is over.
Oh, shit.
And at this moment in time, you know, the writing's been on the wall. So it's not like a super surprise. We all know when mm-hmm. something bad is going to happen in a relationship. But I wasn't caught blindsided.
Okay.
But I was at a point where I just wasn't going to fight to keep a relationship going anymore that was just, you know, sort of fragile and fraught.
Sure.
And I was like, okay, what am I going to do? I mean, immediately texting other people. And I got LASIK. Dude, your boy was ready for a midlife crisis. I got some bongos.
Yo. Oh shit.
I got like a fedora.
Oh my god.
I was ready for like a live, laugh, love spring, you know? Because if you're gonna be single, like New York springtime through mm-hmm. summer is probably the best time to be
sure.
out there, thirsty.
Mm-hmm.
No attachments, no entanglements. Get entangled.
Right.
And because the breakup was amicable, it wasn't really like anybody cheated on anybody. There was no domestic abuse. There's no police reports.
Right.
We made a plan where she could stay in the apartment until April 1st. She booked a RV to travel across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I'm getting my LASIK and I'm recovering in the bed, you know, I'm wearing those sunglasses that old people wear when they get their cataracts taken out.
Yeah,
the wraparound.
Sure.
The Scott Summer Cyclops glasses.
The Tony Gwynn outfielder glasses.
And I'm listening to Democracy Now! Every day, and I'm hearing these rumbles from across the world, right? Like, comics had already been making, like, Corona with Lime, like, hacky jokes at the open mics.
Mm-hmm.
But we're starting to hear that the world is getting shut down, you know, and it's like dominoes falling as we go from, like, China to France and Spain and Italy. And it's wild, dude. So around the 15th, we get shut in, and she tells me that her RV got canceled. And I was like, okay, I guess you can stay.
The RV got canceled. Did it touch another car?
Yeah, they just because all business at that moment really just shut down.
That was just a bad joke. I was gonna like, did the RV get me too'd? Sorry about that.
Yeah, dude, that RV got canceled. So for real, hashtag everybody was against it.
Yeah,
and. So I was like, well, why don't you stay with me here? We'll just partition our 1.5 room apartment into a Pacheco wing and your wing.
Mm-hmm.
We ordered a rice paper wall partition, like one of those Japanese geisha like curtains.
Yeah.
And we put that in the kitchen, and she had the other end of the apartment. And that was it, man. So she stayed here for 3 months with me, and it was like 90 day ex fiance.
So I'm guessing. Oh man.
Yeah. So you were asking how things are going, and it's like, you know, I'm sure other people had to look out their window from their apartment and see freezers full of corpses. So I'm feeling fine.
Yeah.
Relative.
Sure.
To how bad it could be.
Yeah. That, I mean, Didn't you guys have a podcast at one point too?
Yeah. So we had a podcast called The Next Binge Thing. Uh-huh. And this, honestly, you know, people were like, dude, you got to make a sitcom about this. You got to make a story. And we had two reality producers call us, reality show producers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, TV people, they're smart, right? They like, you know, went to liberal arts colleges and they read the books. They read Moby Dick, maybe. They took communication classes. And so we're having these interviews with these producers, and they are cool. Like before we get to the business of the show, like, hey, what are you doing to, cause they're shut into their place too. So we're all bonding over the trauma of being shut in at home.
Yeah.
Like, how are you dealing with this? I'm meditating. What are you doing? They're like, I'm journaling. We're talking like humans. And then they would always get to a point in the meetings where they were like, but now tell us what it's really like. Tell us about the fights.
Yeah.
Can one of you go to the other room? And they'd like, you know, separate us and try to see like how they could, you know, put a wedge between us.
Right.
To manufacture this like, you know, fake drama.
Mm-hmm.
And like, obviously I think the fake drama for reality shows is that's the high fructose corn syrup, right? Like we know that that's going to get you views.
Sure.
But I truly believe that there's a space in media for there to actually be the story of the well-adjusted breakup.
Mm-hmm.
The conscious uncoupling is a story that people that maybe they don't know they want it, but they would love to see it once it's on for them.
Yeah, yeah. Shout out to Gwyneth Paltrow too. Yeah.
Word,
yeah,
Gwenny.
Yeah.
I learned from her.
I think we all did in certain ways. We did. Yeah, her indie movie film career with Miramax. Since we're on this now, we're kind of on this. Like the reason why I want you on here is because I was going through the Instagram and I saw a collection of pictures that you had posted, and it's from about 4 days ago. So that would be the 26th of September, I want to say. And I'm going to read this so everybody can hear this. This is what sparked my, I said, oh shit, I got to get Gabe back on. here we go.
Yeah.
I'm cherishing every opportunity to perform live outside. Each outdoor show has been more unique than the last. Shout outs to my friends Pat and Pam for attending with their newborn pandemic baby last Tuesday. The baby counted as one of my bringers. hopefully New York City venues invest in heated lamps so we can keep yelling at people on Flatbush Avenue during blizzards. Tragically, we are about to enter the Snowpiercer era of comedy, where only the extremely wealthy with ranches or farms will have pods with rapid tests on hand and will have a few of us dancing monkeys delivered to them a la Seamless. And all the tail end of train performers will wait until they are chosen like first seat violinists and sent to the front of the train. We are entering the era of live comedy for the one percenters. And then you talk about how, you know, the shout outs and all that stuff. And I was like,
I thank God.
Yeah. And I was like, oh shit. Yeah. I think you're on to something. And I think you're just kind of touching on it before everybody really starts to understand that. But I mean, people have kind of alluded to this, but why do you feel that way? What compelled you to post that?
So, I mean, I'm going to say very explicitly that seeing some photos from Chappelle's compound, definitely made me think that right away.
Sure.
And I heard that some peers of mine had been flown out there and they got a rapid test and they stayed, like in a cabin overnight, and then once they got cleared, they went and joined the festivities.
Okay.
So when I heard that, I was just thinking about like all this zombie literature. Like I think I read World War Z and the book, which is great. And
okay.
They just talk about how like the wealthy during the zombie apocalypse just would go and like almost have influencer houses where like all the rich celebrities would gate themselves off. And they had a private security guards.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so this is the short story. In the short story, these wealthy people, and there's like analogs to Ann Coulter in this and analogs to P. Diddy. And they're all like hiding in this mansion with fences. And they could have possibly survived the zombie apocalypse, but they were dumb because they started streaming how they were living. So they started posting it online. And what that did was it got all of the desperate people, the people who were running away from zombies, to try to invade their fortresses for safety. And then as the refugees streamed in to try to save themselves, they attracted the zombies.
Mm.
So it's almost like the hubris and the vanity of like needing to continue to show off in the middle of this crisis is going to be your downfall.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like a direct connection where I was like so resentful to the fact that something as frivolous as this comedy show would merit people getting rapid tests.
Yeah.
Where in New York, public school teachers are having panic and anxiety attacks about whether or not they can go back to school. You know, and there's like a gun, like this sort of metaphoric gun being held to the head of all of these essential workers that have to continue to, you know, go to these places so that just the organs of society can continue to work and we can do stuff.
Yeah.
And like, why waste the fuel on flying a performer to a cat, like a ranch? And then why do they get the rapid test?
Mm-hmm.
And then the sort of audacity to like, you know, post this like live, laugh, love photo in the middle of all this bullshit.
Yeah. Well, that kind of bothered me too. And I mean, I haven't done like I have not done stand up since I want to say mid February. I want to say February 15th to be quite exact. And I was going to, like, I had done a week at the Borgata and I had a one nighter that was on like the Jersey Shore, like in that general area. And then after that, I was, yeah, it was fun. It's actually a real, you know, I went on kind of a little rant last week on the episode that's currently up, just talking about how beautiful New Jersey is and how much I really like it here.
Dude, you're right about New Jersey. Yeah. I just have to, you know what made me fall in love with New Jersey? It was watching The Sopranos.
I
want to live. Yeah.
I actually mentioned like, it's not just that weird smell coming up the turnpike near Sea Caucus. There's like more shit. There's more shit. And it's not just like the shore where people, you know, tend to visit around this time where they get their last hurrah of the warm weather in. It's a beautiful state. I mean, you know, it's not perfect, but I think it's, I would, let's put it this way. If I had the money, I don't think I would move. Like if I became successful, if we still have an industry, you know, I would stay here. I would stay in Jersey.
Well, think about, you know, all of these multi-millionaires who, affluent people who live in Jersey. Eddie Murphy bought a house in Jersey.
Yeah.
Chris Rock bought a house in Jersey. Joe Piscopo.
Yeah.
Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
It's, yeah. It's wonderful, man. I you know, every state has something beautiful to it. And I think Jersey gets a bad rap because people are driving through it on these highways.
Yeah.
Or you just see the part of Jersey that's right next to New York, mm-hmm. which is where all of the, you know, shipping containers and right. garbage dumps are.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I just haven't done it. And then like, you know, that was like February and then I was working on a play before the shutdown. And so that's why I wasn't like getting up. And it was just like, man, I miss it. Like I was talking about all the stuff that actually doing the act of stand-up comedy, I miss that. But then everything around it, I miss too. Like I miss like, oh, you know, we would do a show together. We talk. How are you doing? I haven't seen you in ages, man. What are you up to? Blah, blah, blah. Shooting the shit and stuff like that I miss. And it's kind of like, well, I'm not established in that regard to where like I would just go do shows and I don't want to get sick. I wouldn't want anybody to get sick. I'm not like passing judgment on you or anybody else that's doing it. I actually kind of admire it, and you know, but it's like for me, I was like, I think I'll chill.
Well, so Chris, I mean, I'd say my perspective is fluid and evolving. And even after I had these resentful feelings and also these very critical feelings of the Chappelle compound,
mm-hmm.
you know, then I heard that he gave rapid tests to his whole town.
Okay.
Right? So
yeah.
Then that really softened it a lot. And I thought that guy is so much more generous than, like, let's say, a Bezos.
Of course. Right? Yeah, yeah.
Or, you know, if we are going to have, like, oligarchs, if we are going to have very wealthy people, it's cool. Like, one, the critique is that they're not giving their money back, that they're not doing anything with it to actually elevate society. And what mm-hmm. Dave did is positive for his town, for his fiefdom.
Yeah.
You know, but like what I meant with my own perspective evolving is that I was not interested in doing comedy on rooftops immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Like the thing that got me out of my apartment was the Black Lives Matter marches.
Like it did for a lot of people, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. That activated us. Right. That activated me. And my ex was still in the apartment at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we were going out to those events and I don't know. I probably went. Not that many, but I'd say I probably went to like 10 marches, 10 events.
Jesus.
Which, and why I say not, that's not that. There are people who have been doing this every day mm-hmm. since June, and I have to acknowledge them because I never want people to think that like I did anything special.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, relative to people who are actually continuing to keep waving this flag and keep this message out there.
Right. Right.
But in going to those events, we were in crowds the whole time and I've gotten tested 3 times
mm-hmm.
because it's easy access. I have access, right? And I have like 2 walk-in clinics and then there's this tent that gives tests at a project like close to me in South Williamsburg.
Okay. So were you in the same place when we did it like a few years back? We did.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I like that place. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm here so I got all these tests and I was like, "Oh crap, like this is fucking cool. BLM didn't mm-hmm. give me COVID."
Yeah.
Like you're not going to get it outside. And then from that feeling, I thought that it's possible to go do stand-up. It's possible to do this outdoors, to stay outdoors. That's the whole thing.
Sure. Yeah.
And I wanted to get a couple of those reps in before the winter kicks in.
Now tell me you're not doing old shit. You're doing
your boy. My set is about my ex.
Okay.
Not her specifically, but our relationship in the dynamics of the apartment. And then also about my experience going to Black Lives Matter.
Okay.
But
see, you're a vet though. Like I wouldn't worry about you, but I had to bring it up. But that's good to know. The caliber of people that do this show, man. I wouldn't think you would, but I had to ask that, you know.
No, there is I've seen it a couple times, and I call it navel gazing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a tension because one, you know, maybe you've got a bit that you haven't done for 3 or 4 years, and now it's your first time on stage in a couple months,
mm-hmm.
and these sort of synapses are firing again. So I've seen comics resurrect old bits, mm-hmm. and like the joy that I can see them get from it, because it's discovering an old friend.
Yeah.
So as an artist, I can see, and I think of stand-up as kind of being a DJ, where I have all of these opinions and insights and ideas and punchlines. And when I get on stage, it's like it's recombining them in this moment. So the set, it's not a linear set list that I have, but more like a hypertext.
Sure. Yeah.
And so when I see an artist pull things out that are old and slip them in with the new, I'm like, yeah, I see what you're doing. And I like that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I don't respect is the navel gazing. So if you come up there now and you're like, let me tell you about how awkward I am, I'm like, oh God, oh great. This yeah. is an all white lineup that's like not telling me anything new about the world or any, because they're still coming from this hyper personal
yeah.
view of stand up that I think is completely irrelevant in a moment of like global transformation.
Sure. Yeah. That's a great way to look at it. Global transformation. It seems like that's what we're going through, and then it's just like shit does kind of go in cycles. I mean, how did you feel about last night? Did you watch the debates?
No.
Oh wow, okay.
Okay. And I posted about that too, because
okay.
the thing is last night this debate, what is like, you know, when Mike Tyson was like hot and you're like, I gotta watch the fight.
Yeah.
And you know exactly how the fight's gonna end and he's gonna knock somebody out in the first 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So people were paying like $1,000 tickets to sit ringside to see 30 seconds. And they were ultimately disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
So watching this debate, it's like we know ahead of time how bad it's gonna be. And yet we think we need to see it as though something different is gonna happen than what we already know. It, like, why would you do that? It's like throwing good money after bad, or what? I don't, you know, it's almost like a compulsion and addiction we have to continuing to watch this train wreck. Now,
yeah.
What I did instead was I rewatched My Octopus Lover, or no, sorry, My
that?
Octopus Teacher.
Is that a horror movie?
No, My Octopus Teacher is like this beautiful movie on Netflix about one man like basically abandoning his wife and son to go swim every day in the same 200-meter kelp forest, and he befriends this little octopus.
Oh, it's like it's a documentary. Okay.
Documents his relationship with his octopus over the course of a year.
Well, I mean, that sounds interesting. I watched it because I was just like, okay, I thought that I would be, I'm so washed, dude. I feel mm-hmm. like I just like, I get up early for work. And so I tapped out around maybe 10:30. It was about to be over. And it was a shit show, but I think, I don't know, man. I think some people needed to see that shit because they needed to understand what they did in 2016 was bad.
Yeah. Well, tell me. So, yeah, give me, what was your takeaway from watching the debates?
I felt like Trump, you know, he interrupted Biden a lot when he, you know, Biden had him on the ropes and he was, you know, mudslinging, talking about his son that died and just talking about his kids, talking about Biden's kids. And he wouldn't, you know, people, he wouldn't renounce white supremacy. You know, of course he wouldn't.
That's right.
And that shocked a lot of people. Like that stand by. I know you saw that stand by and stand down, you know, stand down line, what he said. And that was like, yeah, he's not going to denounce white supremacy because he's a white supremacist.
Yeah. Dude. Yes. So, Chris, I think what I wanted to bring up when I kind of dismissed why I don't need to watch the debates because Donald Trump's father was a slumlord mm-hmm. who didn't house black Americans in New York City mm-hmm. in the 1970s. And then Donald Trump is a slumlord. Donald Trump also wrote that scathing, you know, he posted that in the newspaper for the Central Park Five.
Yes.
You know, he wanted to get innocent black teenagers executed, wanted to give them the death penalty for something they didn't commit.
Mm-hmm.
The kids are still in cages. His number one, one of his number one dudes in the cabinet is Steve Miller, who is 100% a white supremacist who is looking to cleanse the United States of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing Donald Trump could do at this point for me to not call him a racist white supremacist.
Yeah. I just know I'm going to do what I have to do when I get my ballot, voting for Joe and hoping for the best. I don't trust people to do the same, you know what I mean? Like there's still people that are undecided after this.
That's wild to me because so when you say that, Chris, like I took this photo, I'll send it to you later.
Okay.
But I took this photo on the subway and you know, on the subway there's these really good ad campaigns that have cartoons mm-hmm. of people wearing masks.
Yeah.
And it shows like three wrong ways to wear the mask and then the right way.
Right.
And it's like the wrong ways are like funny. One of them's like the mask over the eyes. It's a blindfold. You know, another one is like mask on the chin. And then another one is just mask covering the mouth, but nose hanging over the mask.
Oh
like
my
Gonzo
God. Yeah.
From the Muppets. And then sitting directly in front of that public service announcement sign were two old white senior citizens, like a couple. And they both had masks on, but they had their noses hanging out.
I took a photo of that. Yeah.
And it's like, all right, what else can we do? Like, these people want to die.
Yeah. Because
they're like literally not looking at, it's not, okay, maybe they can't read. That's one thing. But there's also graphics, so you can see it, you know? And this is New York, so of course the sign is also in Mandarin and Spanish.
Yeah.
So if you don't understand any of these languages and you... I'm wearing this mask to keep your rickety asses alive. You know what I mean?
Right. Like,
and you don't even have the courtesy to do that shit too.
Right.
So those are basically Trump voters. It's like, what can you do to redeem that?
I don't know. And people continue to say, oh, all these people, the racists have to die off. Well, who are those racist people teaching? They're teaching the kids. They're teaching them that shit. It's not going anywhere. That's white supremacy is as American as apple pie and all those metaphors, dude. That shit's not. It's embedded in the DNA of our country. And it's so bad that people who look like you and me try to get it too. And that's even worse, man. It's even worse. And it's like, it's. As much as I don't know, because it's easy to be pessimistic and negative and cynical and look at, you know, we're comics and we're going to look at the world and we're going to look at what's wrong. There's still part of me that kind of believes that we can turn things around, I think.
Uh-huh.
But it's just like, I don't, I don't trust, like, especially after 2016. Shit, man, 2008, I was like, he won? He fucking won? I mean, I voted for Obama, but it was just like, right. You know, it was like, whoa, okay. And then to me, it seems like things got worse when it came to race relations. I mean, that, like, I started to see a lot of that stuff, because I even talked to my dad. My dad, he'll be 80 next year. My mom will be 77 by the end of the year. And I'm thinking about them. I'm like, you know, I was like, it seems like this shit's getting worse, even though Obama's president, like racism and stuff. And they were like, yeah, I would agree. Yeah. You know, like it seems like things are getting, you know, obviously, dude, things are, you know, it's exploded into, we got a mushroom cloud of this bullshit.
Well, Chris, I'm reading a book right now that I really love, and I was recommended by Ramon Rivas, who's he's a brilliant comic. I love out of Ramon. Ohio.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Did his festival.
So good, right? Accidental Comedy Festival was great.
Yeah.
And he recommended this book, and I'm reading it because of him now. And it's an African American and Latinx history of the United States.
Okay.
And I teach history to little kids. Like, who is it?
Who is it by?
It's by Paul Ortiz.
Okay. Okay.
But there's like the little, very what is it? The short-lived period right after the Civil War, mm-hmm, of Reconstruction.
Yes.
Which was like such a wildly progressive moments in the South, and it would be shocking today to see like our implicit racism, how shocked we would be now to have it, like the fact that there were, you know, so many black politicians in charge,
mm-hmm,
so many democracy was actually democracy where there wasn't disenfranchisement yet.
Right.
You know, all of these black veterans from the Civil War were coming back home, and they, because they knew how to fight, there was self-defense in these towns and neighborhoods and cities. Like Key West was like this vibrant multicultural community in Florida.
Hmm.
And it would look today, if you went back in a time machine, it would look like the future rather than like a long time ago.
Yeah.
In the way that people were relating to one another. And then you see the South, the oligarchs in the South were finding ways to divide us again. And they did that through poll taxes and through, you know, Jim Crow laws and voter disenfranchisement.
Yeah.
So I see these cycles, you know, like your parents, they told you that things seem worse now. And it's probably true. Like we this wave crested in the 90s, I'd say, or around inclusion. And since 2000, it's just been rolling back.
Yeah. It's like a weird thing with like equality. People think that they're losing shit. And it's been something that was bubbling, you know, even before Trump got elected, in the like the black comedy community, how, you know, you would hear, and I'm pretty sure you were aware of this, but some of my black comics would message me. They'd be like, hey man, what do you think? These white guys are on this podcast talking X, Y, and Z and saying that they're not getting anything because of diversity. And it's like, and this was before like Trump got elected, and it was just, I kind of noticed some stuff, and I'm like, there were people that had said stuff, and I'm like, hey, if you've been on Conan 4 or 5 times, nobody's taking anything from you. You have to start to look at yourself and to say, am I good? Am I that good? Are these opportunities, were they just given to me? And because somebody just gave me a shot? And you, why am I stagnant? And you notice, like, even before this stuff broke, you know this shit. Your ears are to the street more than I am, and because you're in the city all the time. People that how long have you been doing stand up? 14?
I did my 15? Dude. I did my first open mic in 2004.
Okay, 2004. Okay, so yeah. That's 16 years, right?
Yeah, I've been bouncing around the city for a long time.
So I'm at 11.
Yeah.
So I just remember just coming to New York City, starting stand up in 09, and I'm looking at people. Oh, these guys are hot. These people are blah blah blah. And they just kind of stayed at a certain point.
That's right.
And it's just like, you know, and then you start to see that pivot. You start to see the pivot into, I'm going to say alt-righty things because that seems to be working. That works when you just get to a certain point. You can't reach that next rung. You get a podcast. And then you start saying this is how I feel, man. Okay, so just kind of, I'm going to try to walk you through this and you tell me if I'm crazy. I see this with white guys, and I also see it with black people, black guys, like the Hotep shit. We have our Hotep shit where you can say, yeah, you want to uplift your people. But then you get to this level where it's just like, but fuck the Jews. And it's like, oh, wait a minute, Nick Cannon.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you like the black people are this, you know, uplift yourself and you feel in a certain kind of way. And then like, it's just like, man, that is, oh no, I can't rock with that. I can't be behind that. We call it that, like that barbershop talk where it's like, oh dude, no, you're, and then on the other side, on the other end, it's like a white guy can say something. It's like, oh man, you know, I think, you know, people should be able to have rights and you shouldn't kill black people, but hey, don't interrupt my brunch. Don't interrupt my brunch or there'll be problems, you know? I don't know. It's just, it's fucking weird, man. It's like, I can go deeper. We could probably talk about that shit off mic, but it's just like, I noticed that when you lean towards a certain way, like your audience just grows exponentially. And here I am with this tiny podcast, just try to be a decent person.
So yeah. Okay. Ultimately the art of stand up and the commerce will reward you in two different ways. Mm-hmm. And commerce will always reward you depending. There's a variety of markets. But what I think of a stand-up is auditioning to be a spokesperson for bullshit or auditioning to be a commercial actor. Okay. Every time we get on stage, the part of you that's an artist says, I wrote this new joke and I am trying to express my truth.
Yeah.
That is a pure artist. But the human, the frail, fragile human is thinking, I want, why are they on stage? Are they on stage because I want validation? I just want people to love me. I just want people to laugh at me. Mm-hmm. I want to be famous. I want to get paid. I want to get laid.
Yeah.
I want my parents to think that I'm successful.
Right.
So I want my people, maybe it's my race, to think I'm successful. It could be any, my community. So thinking about it that way, you know, a hacky comic might get a Verizon commercial.
Yeah.
And now other comics are going, look at that guy. He's successful because he's got a Verizon commercial. Mm-hmm. I want to get paid like that, you know, or maybe they think that that's enough. That ring that you got is enough. With it, when it comes to these alt-right dudes, it's like maybe they weren't all right. And then they made one joke in their set really, really struck a chord with that alt-right crowd. And they all start commenting on his Reddit page or whatever. And after that, he's like, okay, well, you start going, it's like a plant moves towards the sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, if you're an artist without an ideology, you start moving towards where the love is.
That's
where the paycheck is.
That's a great point. Wow. The artist without an ideology. Shit.
You know, if you don't have a strong, like, if you don't have integrity around, you know, some values, then you're easily swayed.
Yeah. And then even also, like, even on the black side, it's like you can shit on black people and get paid. Like your Candace Owens of the world and some of these like black quote unquote conservative comedians. And it's fascinating to watch, definitely. And I just wonder, you know, it really makes you think, Gabe.
It really makes you think. It makes you think about, and I can see where when a performer starts out, it depends on what the aesthetic of the time was. Mm-hmm. So like, there's all these comics that were alt comics in the early 90s that were vibing with more of a ironic racism, or they were trying to be, casually offensive.
Right.
Because they were living into this free speech ideology. They were like, I am telling the truth, or I'm going against propriety. I'm going against polite society. Yeah. And at that moment, also that moment was a moment of political correctness.
Yeah.
So you're cool. You're pushing against. That's a little punk rock to be a little offensive.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but those same people who grew, the ones that were able to grow out of it, because their dominant ideology is one of progress. So like, I think of like a Patton Oswalt.
Yeah.
Right. Some of his earlier jokes by today's standards are, you know, dude, why are you making fun of midgets? Like, why are you doing that? You know, I don't even know if I should say that term, but you know.
Yeah, I think even he would tell you, he would say, you know, I remember he did a thing. He did a night at the Kennedy Center, and Reese Waters interviewed him, and he was just talking about certain bits and stuff like that. And I just remember him saying in past interviews, just saying stuff like, that was like, I'm never going to get married. And then he ended up getting married. You know, like that's him. That's like a snapshot of him at a certain age. And then it's like the phones and like our technology, you get that upgrade, you get that update. And it's like, oh, I probably shouldn't be talking about people like that. Let me fix that wiring. Cause I know when we were kids, I used to say shit that I shouldn't have said or call people stuff or acted in a certain way, you know, and I was like, oh, that's not right. I feel bad. Dude, that I
went
that
to an all boys school in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. You were Gonzaga, right?
No, I went to St. Anselm's Abbey School for boys.
Okay.
Which is fine. It was a great place to grow up. Gonzaga, we played against them in basketball.
Okay.
But dude, I grew up in a black city.
Yeah.
I went to like a predominantly white middle school, and my parents are like mixed, mm-hmm. you know, white and Mexican, and I grew up in a multicultural house. However, and all of their friends are different, but you know, there's a lot there was a lot of politically incorrect dialogue.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And I've grown a lot, you know, from maybe how I used to talk when I was in high school.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'd like to think that I did too. I think I did. I mean, it's, I don't know, man. Like you have like a lot of time now more than ever to think. And you think about how fast life is, and how when you're doing something like, you know, before you quote unquote make it, you have to do a lot of shit. Like, especially in show business, like you're going all the time. You're working a day job or something. You're doing that all day. Then you go do stand. I was like, God, 11 years. And then you've been doing it 16. And it's like, well, fuck. And now you slow down. It's like, oh, God, I did all this stuff.
I did all this stuff. And dude, one of my first jokes, it was like, I watched it recently. I watched a very old tape. Uh-huh. And I'm like, I weigh like 120 pounds at the time. I'm like a tiny little bird boy. Mm-hmm. And I'm on stage and I don't talk for like a minute and a half. And people are laughing just because of the way I'm bugging my eyes out. And then I say, I'm not like most Americans because I'm not fat. and the room erupts in laughter.
Yeah.
And now I feel so bad about that joke.
It's a good joke, dude. Like, it's a good joke. It is what it is, man.
It is. It was at the time. Like, it, you know, it hit. It hit. Like, when you're, and I'm like, mathematically, this is a perfect joke with presentation, cadence, punchline. Yeah. However, I don't know if I want to tell that joke now because of who I am and the empathy I have for other people.
Yeah, of course. Well, one thing I re-listened to your album, Risky Behavior.
Thank you. In
stores, wherever you stream and buy music. My favorite joke I would have to say on there is the ice joke.
Yeah.
Because it's like you didn't. Where did you tape that in Brooklyn?
I taped that.
Where'd you tape it?
The Secret Loft in Manhattan.
Okay.
And so the story behind that is I love how I put that album out because I went and I watched other, and this is for anybody listening around putting out an album.
Mm-hmm.
So many people would book like one or two shows at a club.
Right.
And they do an early show and a late show. And I watched a couple people do that. And the nightmare scenario is that they have to paper the room. They have to ticket, they get people in. And my friend, she performed, and there were like five drunk Australian dudes with faux hawks sitting right up front.
Mm.
And they needed a bouncer to get them out before she could finish her set. And that shook her for the rest of her performance.
Yeah.
So it was like, okay, you've wasted all this social capital on getting people to like basically to fill a room twice as a bringer.
Yeah.
When I did my set at the Secret Loft, the guy running it, Alex, was so great, man. He said, yeah, I'll give you 45 minutes to do a set at the end mm-hmm. of a show. And I didn't promote it at all. I had Tyler Fisher host.
Okay.
And then I think it was like Joyelle Johnson, Christina Galston, like he booked the show. I didn't even book it.
Yeah.
Like Mike Racine, all these killers performing before me. And then after like an hour and 15 minute long lineup show of people with bigger credits than me, they were like, hey, do you mind if this guy comes up? He's going to record an album now. And then I just went up and I did an hour and 5 minutes.
That's dope.
And that's like the snapshot I wanted to give people was something like this could happen at any night in New York City comedy
mm-hmm.
where like the unknown guy can come up and just record an album and have a great set.
You did. And I think it was unapologetically you. But that bit stands out for me because it's like, I don't know what I could assume. Where is that club at? What's the demographic of like, tell me where it is and the demographic of the type of people that were in the room. Yeah.
So I would say that it's probably like, it's internet savvy people that would go on Eventbrite to buy tickets.
Gotcha.
So all of the promotion was done online mm-hmm. and all of the promotion was done for, I'd say like young professionals who live in Manhattan.
Perfect. That's what I thought.
Because, no tourists, really,
mm-hmm.
and no Brooklyn hip. It wasn't hip. The crowd was not hip.
Okay, yeah, all right. That's good. Continue, yeah. I'm sorry.
No, but also being able to perform for a crowd that was not on my side initially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I felt, I think it's cool if you're able to can like hypnotically convince an audience over the course of a set to vibe with your wavelength.
That's what you have to do every night. That's what you do every night on the, especially on a long set. If you're doing 20 in like Delaware somewhere, but I want to get to this joke. I asked you that because of the way, like you didn't let up on that joke and that's not necessary. And in that, I was like, is this in Brooklyn? Because you didn't let up on those motherfuckers. And that's what I liked. Because when it started to get dark, like when you just kind of posed the question, what kind of person grows up to be an ice worker? And then just like the refrain of you saying ice, you know, like it's just like, and then you go back into like it transitions into I don't know. It just fucking stands out to me as a great bit because of the way you delivered it and because of you having the fortitude to not, you know, let up on it even when they groaned. You were just like, no, this is what I'm telling you. And, you know, I don't want to give the bit away, but it's just sort
That's fine.
How you say, okay, you get rid of all these people and we're all going to be around at a party with chips and no guacamole. It was just like, yeah, motherfuckers. Like, what are you, you know, it's just the same. It's a great bit. I really love that one.
Thanks.
And especially the way, like when you do it in front of an audience like that, I'm assuming that we're mostly white.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's for others,
mm-hmm,
to get a window into, and it's not letting people off the hook.
Yes, exactly. And it's like, that takes balls. That's not like, see, that's the thing that people don't understand. The people don't seem to understand. There's comics that don't understand that. Well, why can't I fucking say I'm edgy? To me, that is the type of material that is important, and I'm giving you this medicine and you're going to take it and I'm going to deliver it. You're a professional. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're a professional.
Yeah.
You're going to, there's punchlines here, but I'm giving you something.
That's right.
That's the thing that just kind of, that's the difference between somebody that's just like, that's a comedian. That's like not somebody that's just like, well, how come you just can't fucking say? Because then you're like, oh, you're going to Mexico? Don't drink the water. It's like, shit, I can go on a Greyhound and go to Flint and get sick off the water there. And they were like, oh, you're going to owe because it's in the fucking country that we didn't tend to this shit? You know what I mean?
Yeah, man. Yeah. And basically, I think what ideologically, or because of my own values, I now always want my material to side with the Black and Brown experience.
Mm-hmm.
As being, I'm on that side. I might not always look like it, but the message is going to be like, we're going to talk about Flint.
Yeah.
We're not.
right.
I don't want to call it punching up because that's not what I mean.
It's just being a comedian, dude. I think you have that awareness. It's like, you're thinking about that shit. Cause if you say most comedians who are good, you think about the things that you want to say for a long time. You may not, before you even get on stage, you're probably thinking about that shit the whole day until you get on stage that night to say what you want to say, because you think that this is going to be, I'm not trying to hurt anybody. I just want to say this shit. This is how I feel. How do I filter this out and disseminate it to make it palatable for a general audience? And that takes a lot of thought. It takes a lot of skill. I think it's just, and then it's just from you doing stand up for a long time. And being comfortable, you know, with who you are and who you are as a comedian. But yeah, I think that's the thing that's kind of missing. And for me, it's a taste thing anyway, you know, where you're saying something that's kind of that is loaded. And then the punch of that is really you went over there, you went to Mexico and you drank the water and you got sick as shit. You know what I'm saying?
Because systemically, that's still a fucking problem.
Exactly. And that's the human element to it. That's what makes it funny. But it's just like, you know, sometimes when I have comics on, I kind of like to do a little bit of a anatomy of a joke and stuff that I appreciate that I think needs to be highlighted in the people that are on. But yeah, like I really loved it because, you know, I texted you when I first heard it. I was like, oh, this is a good album, man. This is really good. You know, but then just listening to it again, it was like that was one that just stuck out to me. Really great fucking joke, dude.
Dude, I appreciate it. And this is, you know, I watch some comics who I think it's a style of comedy that I really like is when someone creates an image and they, a good joke or bit is like a song.
Yeah.
Where it can have a chorus and you can come back to the chorus and you can make those words sing.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way that a song will uplift you at moments or will make you be sad and then bring you back, a good bit, you get the biggest laugh if you take them someplace low first.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it can't just be like set up, punch, set up, punch, set up, punch, because then it's, you know, I don't know. I think that's like seltzer water to me. It's just like, it's bubbly and forgettable. And maybe that is, I think, something that the industry wants.
Yeah.
Because it's easier to sell bullshit with that.
Right.
But if you've got a bit that's like, is poignant, like Chappelle's got those bits and Hicks had those bits and Pryor, and I just look up to them.
Yeah.
I don't want to put myself in their league, but no, I look at them and I go,
yeah,
that's the type of stuff I like watching and what I want to strive for.
I always tell the story, and I think it's fitting to tell it here. You always look at people like that. Like, I look at people hear me talk about Burr on the pod all the time. And I remember seeing him in the round at in Long Island at Westbury. And he's doing the helicopter bit that he does. And that's like a signature bit of his. And that's like one of my favorite bits of his. And I'm watching it. And I'm just like, I got to quit comedy. I'm never going to be that good. And like, there's like, you know, I guess that 12 steps, what is it? It's like denial, set, whatever it is. Like, you get all these emotions. I was washed over with all these emotions. And then I was just like, but I can try. I can still try to be that good. You know?
Yeah.
In my own way, I can try, you know, and to me, that's the fun in it. The fun is, you know, the game of it is, okay, how do I tell this joke that's really fucking, like, you go to these low places. How can I bring them up from that? How can I dig myself out of that hole with the subject matter and make them laugh? Like, but it's something that you're really compelled to say, but you want to make sure that you say it with this dexterity, this alacrity that just, like, fucking hits them, you know?
Yeah, man, because you want somebody that doesn't agree with you to have their brain twisted for a second, and when they laugh and then they feel it,
yeah,
and they go, okay, like, I'm gonna remember that for later,
right?
And it's gonna, hopefully you've just dropped a seed, right?
Mm-hmm.
That will give them a different perspective.
And because you put that album out last year, have you been, like, after that, were you just, like, putting something else together, you know? Like, what were you just, like,
just yeah. Work?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, well, one great thing about this this time of being alone has been the use of Post-it notes all over the apartment. My apartment looks like a room in Seven, okay. Right? Just like...
yeah.
And or one of the rooms has that vibe, and I do have a couple strong bits that I think are that I didn't put on the last album, mostly around education,
okay,
and school shooters, and I got one bit that I'm working on now that's just basically, you know, when Louis came out and he did that bit on school shooters,
right?
They got leaked immediately after that. You know, people were really upset that he was performing, which is fine.
Yeah.
And then, but the other thing that kind of people were upset about was like, he shouldn't be talking about this. It's so callous.
And that's what made him Louis. He's talking about shit like that.
And what I would say is no, it's a perfect, it is in fact the best topic.
Yeah.
School shooting is the best topic for a stand-up comedian to talk about. And it's just about finding the way to sing it, and the perspective. So I have to give him credit for inspiring me to try to come up with something better. Because, like, comedy's also bad. It's a battle and it's a conversation.
Yeah.
Where you're listening to your peers and you're thinking, okay, well, how can I do that better?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Yeah. I don't remember it being that bad. It was just kind of like, it was just like, it was like, cause I listened to that set and I was like, it's not, we just not supposed to like him right now.
I mean, he's still a master.
He's still one of the best. Dude, I keep saying, like, I watched that. I bought the last special because,
yeah,
one, I wanted to see, like, the thing that would let me down. Obviously, you know, you don't harass women. You don't, you know, sexually assault or make it. You don't do shit like that. But you have this master comedian who, if he was going to come back and he didn't address it, I would have problems with that.
That's right.
Because you're one of the best to ever do it. And if you don't address it, then I will lose respect. He did it enough in that special. Yeah. I thought, like, you know, as a fan of the, as a practitioner, I kind of would have liked to see more, but he did enough for me. I was like, okay. Some of the other stuff was good too. You know what I mean? I always, like, since I started doing comedy, like, the people that I really admired were Louis, Burr, and Patrice, because of this, like, this everyman aesthetic where it's just really like a heightened version of who these guys are. Like, they're not, well, there's no real, to me, it's like that. There's not much of an artifice. Yes, it is an act, but there's not that much artifice around it, you know?
I mean, young Bill Burr, I think it was his first HBO, maybe.
Okay.
It's when he's like on the subway and he's got a black girlfriend.
Yeah.
And everybody's calling him Howdy Doody.
Mm-hmm.
That was that special came out right before I started.
Okay.
And so he was the first, like, I'd say, like, white New York City stand-up comedian. I didn't have cable, so I didn't watch a lot of stand-up.
Yeah.
He was, like, the first white comic I saw who was like, oh, I like how this guy's, like, kind of, you know, inserting himself into, like, a discourse with race.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like,
yeah.
Not, you know, because, you know, there's Seinfeld, I think, is, like, another example, but of not race, though, of sort of, like, what I thought of as a white New York comedian. Like, well, I'm going to talk about chewing gum.
Yeah.
You know, and Burr's like on the subway,
mm-hmm,
and like sort of talking about interacting with people from different cultures in a funny way.
Right, right, right.
So I gave Burr a lot of credit for just being influential right before I started.
Yeah. Because when I started, before I started stand-up, it was like Martin, Paul Mooney, Pryor, Rock, all those, you know, all those like Comic View folks. And
yeah.
And then when you get on stage, it's like, you know, it's nothing. I'm nothing like those. Like the swagger is not there. Like, it's not. I'm just me. I'm just a dude. But it's like, but then like when you find yourself and then you start doing it, it's like, oh, these people are influential. These people, you know, but it definitely. It's just that every man, I think with you, like knowing you for as long as I've known you, we're not BFFs, but I know you, you're a good dude. We've talked, whatever.
Yeah.
And I like listening to your albums, like that's Gabe. That's not anything that's put on. It's just, this is who that guy is, you know?
Dude, I appreciate that. Yeah. That's the goal.
Yeah.
Is and the longer I've done this, the more happy I am just being myself.
And that, I think that, you know, that comes with a lot of time and just being somebody that's the age that we are.
Yeah, you're like, I'm just going to bomb gracefully.
No.
But in fact, that looks good. And people, and it's not, and the thing is that it's no longer a bomb.
Yeah.
We're just in the art of being ourselves.
Right. Right.
In a way that's clear for the world to see.
How do you feel about this stuff, man? Do you think it's going to come back though? You know, like it used to be to some version of that?
Man, that's such a hard question. Mm-hmm. I'm still watching specials. Like, I think, you know, I just listened to Ted Alexandro's Cut Up. I love that album. I just rewatched Eddie Pepitone's latest album.
I heard that's really good, right?
Yeah, it's really good.
What's it? Is it? Because I know you can hear, but is it streaming too?
It's streaming, yeah.
On like Netflix or Amazon or something?
I think it was on Amazon.
Okay.
But just those two names, Ted Alexandro, Eddie Pepitone, those guys. And then I rewatched George Lopez's most recent special.
Okay.
And it's, you know, I love George. So these, I think it's, there's a hunger. People still are hungry for stand up. The issue is that the world is changing so quickly, and stand up is an art form that is a stalagmite art form, where you every day you get on stage is like one more drop of that mineral infused water dropping down on the ground, and it's like it takes a thousand sets to like build this mound that is the final product. And that's a problem right now for performers being able to get out to do that.
Right. That's like, cause that's why I felt like, I was like, I'm not going to do it. Like, I was afraid of death and everything. So I put out like a little EP that to me is like, it's all A, but it's like, it's not like, it's like Ted's special cut where up. It's like cut up. It's like from the DC Improv, from the Borgata, from Gotham, you know, it's like, but I want like what you had, like the hour, like I was ready to do that. And, you know, I still have stories that I want to tell, and I have Evernote on my phone, and I just have a folder where that's called The New Danger. And it's named after Mos Def's second studio album. And
I can't wait to hear it. I can't wait for you to put this out.
Yeah. So it's just like, it's not like that's just a folder. It's like, but I have a title that I'll tell you about off mic. But it's like, it's just, you know, I still feel that hunger, and I still like that's, it's just like, I hope that we get to a point where we can get back to what, you know, we were doing. Cause that's part of what makes New York go to. It is the restaurants, it's the cool sites, but it's also the artists as well, you know. Like we make a lot of this stuff go too. And I, like I said, even when it comes to what I didn't say with you, and I think maybe you can speak on this too. When it comes to the protests, when it comes to activism, the one thing I'm noticing that has given me hope is more white people seem to be involved.
Yes. And you'll hear a backlash to that. Sometimes you'll hear I went to the BLM march and it was all these white people.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, and it's like, yeah, that's what is needed for a multiracial, multicultural unity.
Right.
To see exactly who the enemy really is.
Yeah.
Because the trick that this devil has pulled on all of us is to make us think that we are separate.
Mm-hmm.
And of course your experience is going to be radically different than mine, but we have the same interests, even if we don't have the same everyday cosmetic desire. Our cosmetic desires might be different,
right?
But our interest is the same.
Sure. Yeah,
that's kind of what I'm getting at. And when I look at this, like the African American and Latinx history of the U.S. was like, you know, one big reason that that the U.S. invaded Mexico in the 1840s and took California and Texas and Utah and Arizona and New Mexico. One reason that they did that was because Mexico had outlawed slavery. Mm-hmm. And Mexico outlawed slavery before the U.S. did. So that made all of these politicians in South Carolina and Florida and Georgia freak out. And they were like, okay, well, we need to invade this other part. We need to take this land so that we can expand slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So the Mexican-American and Mexican solidarity with, like, African-American slaves was already there. And, like, the white supremacy, it was is pushing us apart from one another.
Yeah. Yeah.
To create, you know, I don't know, to just create this, like, basically
chaos.
To perpetuate the slave state that we still live in. I mean, we're in, you know, quote, hashtag free, I guess. But with voter disenfranchisement, it's still the minority of white people in these states that dictate policy that affects all of us.
Yeah. Yeah, man, that I did want to touch on, want you to touch on that too, because it, I think that that's important to say. And I've said it on the show a bunch of times, you know, like at, when everything was kind of at a fever pitch and we are in an election year and the debates last night were just kind of a bummer. And it was just like, you know, but, you know, I'm just really glad that Biden, he did say, he said, you know, you're the worst president in the history of this country. I was like, oh, I was like, God, I was glad that he touched on that. Like, so yeah, it's just kind of like this, like, okay. And I'm, you know, I was like, I don't really want to watch. And then I just knew, like, this was just one of those nights. Last night was one of those nights where it was just like, well, I actually worked on an audition, like a socially distanced audition, like put myself on tape with my manager for some shit. And
good for you, man.
You know, it's like, okay. I mean,
hashtag grinding.
Yeah. Hashtag grinding.
pull up,
you know, and that kind of felt weird too.
Right.
And it's like, you see, and it's a thing, like when we talk about like Chappelle and the camp, and you know, they had to, COVID doesn't give a fuck that he's got that money, because they had to shut down those last few shows.
That's right.
You know, and it was just sort of like, man, and you're on social media and you see all these people making deals, and this person's going to be super fart boy in 2028. And they sign this deal and that deal. And you see this stuff happen and people are shooting things. And it's like, well, man, I was thinking, like, I'm risking my life going to my day job every other day. If I die on a show for Amazon Prime, you know, doing what I loved.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that would be great. Yes. And the flip side of that coin is, how corny would it be that if you decided to go do a show on a rooftop of an unsafe place,
yeah,
and you had a mediocre set and you got COVID-19?
Exactly. That's 5 minutes the thing. Yeah. Bombing. And I just bombed on some new idea. That's just like,
Yeah. And the MC walked half the room,
mm-hmm,
and they put you up really late.
I'll say, like, you know, okay, well, I get a part on a TV show, give my parents a little bread, you know, and pay some bills and shit. Like, I'm doing that with the day job, so I would do it. Like, I told my, like, theater's not coming back until, right, like, God knows when. The Met just canceled their 2021 season. So, and that's supposed to be like a precursor to what's going to happen with other live shows in the city. So, like, it's just kind of like, man, like, well, ooh, like,
well, Chris, this is what I think, man, for you and for me and for one way for anybody listening to this that's really set on being a comedian is shifting your identity from comedian to artist.
Yeah, that's because true.
If we're creative, then, you know, it's almost like life finds a way. Your creativity, you can pour it into, you know, a multitude of other avenues during this time, be it podcasting, be it making short videos. Like, I'm reading every day. I like flip tarot cards. I read my own tarot cards now every day. And some people are like calling me up to have sessions.
Yeah.
So for anybody who listens to this, if you want a tarot card reading from Gabe Pacheco, I got you.
What's your social media?
Oh, my social media is Gabe Pack 1, GABEPAC 1.
Cool.
And I draw, and I'm drawing every day. Like, when you asked how this is affecting me, I work from home, mm-hmm, but I'm a cozy boy, dude. I'm ready for like a winter on Hoth. I got a tauntaun. I made my apartment like the inside of a tauntaun.
That's what's up.
I got rugs in every room, pillows on the floor, a Muji diffuser, like those red chili pepper lights, a bunch of plants.
All right. You're doing it. Hey, dude, look, man, when you're absolutely right with like shifting. And it's like, I thought about that. Like, I was like, oh, well, because my manager's like, you're an actor.
Yeah.
You know, I am, but it was just sort of like, yeah, I got to. Yeah. And then I bought Final Draft last week. So
you can thank
an argument with one of my friends who told me I needed to write and that I didn't need a PlayStation 5. And you can thank him, and you can thank COVID-19 for whatever comes from that purchase.
Yeah, the next David Mamet over here.
Short clip lines. Fuck, shit, fuck. Oh, man. Yeah. Well, Gabe.
Weeds. Yeah.
this has been a fucking pleasure. This is everything that I dreamed it would be. I'm so glad you're able to do this, and that my Zoom recorder decided that it was gonna fucking work, and that we could do this. Hold on to the line, and everybody, thank you so much for listening. Check out Gabe, follow him on social media, check out his album Risky Behavior, and take it easy. We'll talk to you next time.
Ciao.